Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3 a.m.
Welcome back to Crib Notes, the podcast answering the questions parents Google at 3 a.m. with me, dad-to-be Rick Kelsey, and paediatric doctor and new mum, Dr. Sarah Blackstock. Today, we welcome back Dr. Max Davey, consultant paediatrician and Royal College of Paediatrics Head of Health Promotion, about how to support your young child's development in children over five. Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
Max, you're becoming quite a regular.
I am. I'm a fixture. I have a little basket in the corner of the pod.
Thank you so much for joining us again. We're really happy to have you here to talk about child development, but this is in the older age groups. This is children who are over 5 years old. Hmm. I guess one of the things we'd like to start with is children of this age, they're just starting school. Is there anything that parents should be specifically looking out for, and how should they be supporting them in this period?
At this point, what happens is that it's schools who are kind of primarily responsible for flagging up difficulties. And so actually, I think the single thing that parents can do is get a good relationship with the school, listen to what the school have to say, and just engage with that. That's the key, because here you have this whole sector of experts coming into your child's life, which can be difficult, but you have to have that relationship early on.
So do you think things are more likely to get picked up now they're in school compared to previously?
A lot of developmental services only go up to five, but ours deliberately goes up through the primary school age group. And we get more referrals at primary school than before primary school. And I think there's a number of reasons for this. I think families naturally and correctly mould themselves around the child. So a child who actually may have some difficulties, you just don't notice it at home because you adapt. You kind of, everyone, particularly children who are a bit trickier, you just kind of mould around them. And then they go to school and there's 30 of them and stand out like a sore thumb, and then, you know, you have to have a conversation. That's one thing. And I think, you know, there probably are families who know that there's a problem, but it's really hard to admit to themselves or to other people that there are difficulties. And obviously there are certain cultures within London particularly where that is particularly difficult. But it's everyone. It's hard to admit that there may be a difficulty with your child's learning or development.
Another thing that seems to crop up in this age group is challenging behaviour and pushing boundaries.
I think the first thing to say is that you've got to understand what the behaviour is communicating. Is it frustration? Is it anger? Is it wanting to not do something or to do something? And that's not to say, oh, he wants to do this thing, so I need to give it to him, just to get the context. And then I've got a five R's system for how to understand what parenting is. And I'll just
Max's
quickly...
Max's R's.
My five R's. So first of all is regard. It's a positive... The therapists talk about unconditional positive regard. You've got to have this unconditional positive regard for your child. So you've got to love them unconditionally and tell them that in quite specific ways. So as in, I love how you did that. I love how you do that. I love this about you, not you're a good boy, because that actually doesn't help their self-esteem for interesting reasons. But you don't have to have positive regard for the behaviour. So you split off, I don't like this behaviour, but I still really like you. Do you see what I mean? The second one is reactivity. So when we talked about screen time before, we talked about how parents being reactive and responding to children is really important. And I think that's really true for behaviour. If you only respond to... Everyone responds to bad behaviour. You've got to respond to good behaviour too. You've got to respond to positive interactions. So again, getting off your phone and being there for the child is really important. And then you've got sort of reliability or structure. So you've got to have structures. That's where consequences start to come in. That's where planning ahead. So one of the flashpoints is the supermarket for someone who's challenging. And when I talk to families in clinic and I say, so what do you do when you go to the supermarket? What's your plan? And they go, what do you mean? Well, yeah, there's not a God-given right for it to be okay to take a child to the supermarket. You've got to plan ahead. You've got to say, okay, if you do this, you get this. If you do that, we go home. And you've got to, therefore, you've got to be able to stick to that. And that's, again, to do with your reliability. You've got to follow through on what you're saying. Then you've got regularity, which is basically you've got to keep going. Your stressed out, hungover self has got to behave in as close as your well-rested, kind of calm self when you're having a cup of tea and making plans. And also, I mean, not, people don't have to parent in partnerships exactly the same, but broadly the same. And grandparents, if you've got challenging behaviour, grandparents often need a stern talking to about boundaries.
And letting them loose.
Letting them loose.
Yeah, and letting them off the hook.
And the final thing, which is used to be basically resilience, is basically when you've got challenging behaviour and you've got a plan, you have to stick with it because the behaviour will get worse before it gets better.
The five R's.
The five R's.
We need to do. We need to do a little graphic on that.
It's an
exclusive. We definitely need to do a little graphic on that. You know, you mentioned there about positive behaviour.
Yeah.
How can we support positive behaviour in children?
I think you just find it and you respond to it positively. So I mentioned briefly in passing, if a child is making a positive interaction to you, you respond to that interaction. It doesn't mean you have to be at the beck and call of your child to say, oh, are you going to say something to me now? You know, if you are busy doing genuinely doing something on a computer or on your phone or you're busy, you say, I really want to talk to you, but I'll do it in a minute. And then you go, right, you wanted to talk to me. What did you want to say? So it's about encouraging that. And I think also it's about catching them being good. And so
acknowledging it.
Yeah, and saying acknowledging it and also acknowledging it specifically. So children who are told you're clever or you're good, actually what that does is set them up an expectation that's quite hard to live up to.
There's an article actually that you
sent me.
Yeah.
And it's true, and there's pretty good evidence that specific praise is much more powerful in building up the child's self-image than kind of general praise.
So give me an example of specific praise.
So, you know, I really like that drawing that you drew. I love the colours in it.
Rather than, you always behave yourself on a Tuesday.
Or on a Tuesday, when I'm here. Or aren't you a good boy? Or you're very good at drawing.
Yeah.
So that's non-specific praise.
Pick out a specific drawing.
I love that. Yeah. That was great.
So they say that children become scared to push boundaries. If they're told that they're clever all the time, they then think this is fixed and that they don't want to, for example, be more adventurous because they might disprove that they're clever.
Ah. It's possible. Yeah. It's possible. I just think it's generally good to be specific in your praise.
That's good. Generally good idea. You know, when it comes to, you know, you mentioned that there's so many things that affect development in over fives, but, you know, we constantly hear about food now and how food changes people's reactions, their growth, you know, but so mental and physical. How important is it to nail an absolutely perfect diet? Because people can't do it, can they?
Does it affect for behavior?
Not really.
Really?
No, it's really overhyped.
We can't just be giving them rubbish.
Well, you can sometimes. It's fine. If you're going to McDonald's and everyone likes McDonald's and you have a McDonald's every now and again, that's kind of okay. So the links between particular forms of diet and behaviour are very, very tenuous at best. So people talk about, you know, one of the kind of most prevalent parenting myths is that sugary
food colorings.
Sugar, well, food colorings we'll come back to, but sugary drinks make children hyperactive. They demonstrably don't. There's good evidence that they actually don't make any difference at all. Food colorings, yes, there are some studies from food colorings in the 1970s that they affected behavior, but those food colorings have been banned by the EU. Obviously, not going to get political, but by the EU, you know, several decades ago. They've not been in the food chain.
Mm.
So,
Sarah, you're really hot on nutrition, aren't you?
Well, it's something that I'm interested in, but I've heard you talk about this before and how it actually the behaviour link just isn't quite there.
It's just not made out. And there's lots of people making lots of money from these myths, which is galling.
And that's but we are talking strictly on behaviour, not on
behaviour. Obviously, obesity is another thing.
Yeah, and health.
We can come back and talk about obesity, but yes, of course. Eating lots of unhealthy food is going to tend to make you more
obese.
It's
about everything in moderation, I guess, as well.
If I give, you know, a five-year-old a kilogram bag of jelly beans, they're going to be a bit hyperactive, aren't they?
They're going to get sick.
I mean, a kilogram is
quite a
lot.
Before they get hyperactive. I wonder why you went for a kilogram and where you get a kilogram.
Let's go for 500 grams.
Wow.
I buy in bulk.
Really,
I go to Costco.
Solid, yeah, exactly. Costco bag of jelly beans. Yeah, they'll get sick, but they won't necessarily get hyperactive.
No?
No, the evidence isn't there. I mean, honestly, if you give them then, they probably won't eat their dinner because they'll be full of that stuff.
And then they might not grow as well.
And then they'll throw up.
Yeah. Which would make an unhappy child.
Unhappy child.
So it's not a good idea.
It's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea.
Bad idea.
Yeah, right.
One of the things that we were talking about earlier was things like ADHD and autism. Mm. Well, you see a lot of patients with this in your clinic.
A lot.
What sort of things should parents be looking out for?
So I think the danger here is that you go online because your child has some either communication or behavioural problem and you get a checklist and you think, oh, they've got this symptom and this symptom and this symptom. They must have a problem. You've got to go back to what these things actually are. They're different kinds of brain, and they're not in themselves bad or worse or broken or any of those things. And I say that to children every day. What they are is just different. So an autistic brain is a brain that finds it particularly difficult to understand instinctively the brains of others, and they need to learn that in a more roundabout way. And actually, they've probably got a broader difficulty with working out patterns and predicting patterns in the world and kind of making sense of the world. And so they tend to kind of withdraw a little bit and into kind of patterns of slightly more rigid behaviour. And that's an autistic child. We complicate it, but that's basically what they are. And all of the things that the difficulties that they have are around those kind of instinctive, almost magical abilities that most people have to tell how someone's feeling and tell what they're thinking just from their face. And if you think about it,
social communication,
it's remarkable that we can do it, but we can do it. An ADHD child, by contrast, the best image I've thought of it is the brain that's constantly hungry, kind of insatiable hunger of the brain. They need stimulation, they need movement, they need emotion. It's just constant, 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 constant. And boredom is like poison to these kids' brains. Mm. So not being stimulated, not having anything to do is really tough. And again, everything flows from there. All the hyperactivity and impulsivity and the poor concentration flows from that central hunger. So rather than look at a checklist to think, what's my child like? Is he kind of like that or not? And then if he is a bit like that, is it causing a problem? Because there are lots of people who find social interaction difficulty. I find social interaction difficult. If you put me in a room full of people at a cocktail party, I'd probably hide. But, you know, that doesn't mean I'm autistic. So it's a question of, is it causing them a problem in their everyday life? And the same is true of ADHD.
So things like headbanging, for example, on its own wouldn't necessarily be a problem.
No, it's very common.
And it's lots of things that parents Google, but actually it's in the normal range.
It's a great example because lots of people, parents Google headbanging and come up with autism and one of the lists that somebody's put up. Not incorrectly, because a lot of kids with autism do headbang. You've got to look at the rest of the context of your child.
I imagine that's a big relief for a lot of people hearing that, actually.
Another thing that parents often worry about is how much stimulation should they be giving their child. So I don't know if you've read a book, for example, French Children Don't Throw Food. And it's about how the French are supposedly more laid back than the Anglophile parents who are, in quote unquote, sort of helicopter parenting.
I was in France a few weeks ago, Max. I saw kids throwing all sorts of stuff.
They were throwing food.
Yeah. I think this is a uniquely... It's also not true that Anglophone families necessarily helicopter parent, because if you look at...
What does that mean, helicopter parent?
So helicopter parent is hovering over the child at all times.
Right.
This probably is a little bit of a cultural thing amongst high-flying professional... metropolitan parents.
You're looking at me. It's not me.
To be a little bit...
That's not going to be my style.
To be a little bit like
that.
I'm
leaving in the corner.
Good. Excellent.
I'm with one
you.
Toy.
I am your Jedi master.
One toy.
No, yeah, exactly. You know, so yes, there may be a little bit of that, but you're saying there's no helicopter parenting in France? Clearly there is.
How can you stop them throwing food, though?
What, stop kids throwing food?
Yeah.
Throw it back. In their face. No.
This was actually a good idea.
Yeah, we've had a couple of these, haven't we? You're right. I was just thinking you just get a dog.
Yeah, well, then it doesn't matter anymore.
With dogs, because then it just clears it up.
But that's...
You haven't got Hoover as well.
So the question is, okay, let's... A good example of... We've done the five R's, which is kind of an abstract thing. Okay, so why is the child throwing food? What are they communicating by throwing the food? Is it simply they don't want to eat the food? Is it that they're communicating that they want attention? Is it that they're communicating that they're angry because you've turned the TV off? What is the context and what are the things? And then you've got to... split off your regard for the child from your lack of regard for the chucking, and then you've got to make a plan. You've got to react to when they don't chuck, when they're eating, when they're putting it in their mouth instead. You've got to be positive. You've got to have a plan and consequences. So, you know, if you throw your dinner again, you are not getting pudding.
thank you so much, Max, for coming on and having a chat with us about this. Just one more final question. Again, parents seem to ask us so much about toys and what toys they should be buying for children. Is there anything specific that you think is useful for children over five?
Yeah, just the single toy. A single toy.
You can, why don't you publish a book in a few years, Rick? The Single Toy Parent.
You know what? If we're still going then, I'll tell you how it went.
It's about its boot. So the thing about toys is that they're just an object. And I think it's really interesting because play is obviously really important and is part of the culture as really important for under fives. But when children hit school, play is sort of downgraded. And a lot of teachers, for instance, will say, oh, it's just a distraction. They don't learn through play anymore. Play is just a kind of recreation.
A break between lessons.
Exactly. And, you know, you come home and you've got your Xbox or your PlayStation and you just play like that. So play is still important. That's one. The only thing I want to emphasise. It doesn't matter what you play with. Play is absolutely vitally important.
Pretend play is particularly useful for children. And at the beginning, they do more individual play, for example. And then as a child gets older, they play with other children.
True. But again, if you have a child who has perhaps an autistic spectrum disorder and, you know, you're trying to force them to do this pretend play because you think it'll stop them being autistic, it won't. And you're just importing other people's standards into your own life. You follow the child's lead. Yeah, of course, you can encourage them towards pretend play. But if you have a child who has a difficulty, and there will be people who are listening to this who have a difficulty, playing with them in a particular way is not going to radically change things.
Fire at me the five R's once again.
So it's regard, positive regard. It's reactivity, reacting to your child positively. It's reliability, having a structure which is reliable and set. Regularity, everyone doing the same thing over time and across parenting. And it's resilience, sticking with it because it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Do you love your job?
At the moment, yes.
Max, seriously, it's always good having you come on. You're always good value for money.
Good value for money. Yeah. For no money.
Frozen food is fine.
Frozen food,
frozen
great.
Food is fine.
Frozen fish, better than fresh fish.
Really?
Frozen at sauce.
God. Much better.
We're not only a parenting podcast, we're also a nutrition and culinary podcast. Max, thanks very much.
Thanks. You're very welcome.
Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3 a.m.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.